In the late 1990s, Ross Lee, then the National Trust property manager at Huendon, approached the then Bodleian's keeper of Western manuscripts, Mary Clappinson, with the proposal that the library should mark Disraeli's bicentenary in 2004 with a major exhibition. Disraeli's papers, which are owned by the National Trust, have been on deposit in the Bodleian since 1978. The two organisations had collaborated in the past over the part externally funded conservation of the collection, known by its provenance as the Huendon Papers, which it concluded 5 years earlier. Fast forward to the summer of 2002 and the start of the work on the exhibition. My curatorial training for the big event had started in 2001 with the Millennium Fellowship secondment to the North London Hampstead home of the architect Erno Goldfinger, as the National Trust prepared to mark his centenary in 2002. It was an invaluable prelude. But the key organising principle for the Disraeli exhibition came from altogether a different source, the Cheltenham Literary Festival in October 2002. By then, some way through Disraeli's papers and testing various lines of approach, I had a ticket to hear Nicola Shulman talk about her biography of the plant hunter, Reginald Farrar. I knew very little about him, other than he'd corresponded with the owner of an Edwardian garden I'd been researching before I embarked on the exhibition. The festival organisers paired Shulman with a fellow author, better known author, published by Short Books, Nigel Nicholson, whose latest book was a biography of the writer, Fanny Burney. The interviewer asked the authors how they approached writing a short biography. Nicholson's reply, and here I paraphrase, was that one treated the life like a river and focused on a series of stepping stones. I remember it as a light bulb moment, seizing on the similarities between a short biography and a medium-sized exhibition. I began to see how to represent Disraeli's life using his personal archive. Back in Oxford, I sketched out a new outline for the exhibition, compressing Disraeli's life story and legacy into 8 exhibition cases, using mainly documents from his private papers, a collection which, tantalisingly, includes more letters to him than by him. In 2005, an online version was added as a historical resource to the Bodleian's website. Within its 14 sections, and I won't read them all out, the exhibition explores Disraeli's personality, his relationships, careers as novelist, writer, and politician, contextualising his place within 19th century politics and his enduring appeal into the 21st. Disraeli's world glips through manuscripts, artefacts, and published material. From the outset, the Disraeli exhibition was a collaborative project. Loans from Huendon, or where, as in the case of large portraits, size and condition made that impractical, photographs, were crucial in giving a flavour of Disraeli's material world. For the opening chapter, Bookish Beginnings, I Was Born in a Library, covering the years 1804 to 25, the library borrowed portraits of Disraeli's parents and his sister. The numbers, incidentally, are from the online exhibition, not from the book. To illustrate Disraeli's true geographical origins, the map room's Nigel James produced this excellent map. Rooting Disraeli in the physical world also influenced the selection of images of spaces he had known. So, alongside an image of the publisher John Murray's drawing room, attended the famous meeting in 1815 by Isaac Disraeli, there are photographs taken in 2003 of the Disraeli family home in Bloomsbury and Disraeli's library at Huendon, the latter referencing Isaac Disraeli's books, but also conveying something of the importance of writing and imagination in shaping Disraeli's personality and actions. John and Virginia Murray very kindly allowed me to sift through Disraeli-related material in the Murray Publishing Archive, then still in its original home in Albemarle Street, it's now in Edinburgh University, agreeing to lend not only the drawing room scene, but also several other items, including the 1840s portrait of Disraeli, we'll see in a moment, and this. This volume, which includes letters in coded passages describing Disraeli's discussions in Edinburgh with Sir Walter Scott and his son-in-law, J.G. Lockhart. Murray had been keen to launch a daily newspaper, and unwisely, given the losses he'd sustained by investing in a Mexican mining company recommended by Disraeli, allowed him to travel to Edinburgh to try and sign up Sir Walter Scott and Lockhart. Back in London, Disraeli recruited the representative's correspondents, but the venture failed. Murray lost £26,000, in recent money just over £1 million, jeopardising the publisher for years and years. The letter was also a useful marker for establishing Disraeli as a risk-taker. He was a romantic too, in early life modelling himself on Byron, as we've heard. Seen left in the well-known drawing of the young author Disraeli and right, Byron's former servant Tita, who Disraeli, travelling in the Middle East, encountered in Malta. Tita, his master Byron having died, was working for James Clay. Disraeli arranged for Tita to become a house steward to his father in Bradenham. It had been on this first trip to Europe in 1824 with his father and his sister's ill-fated fiancé William Meredith, he would die during the 1831 Middle East trip, that Disraeli had decided to become a writer. These pages describe an attempt to visit Rubens' house in Antwerp in August 1824 and his interest in architecture and local customs. He drew on his experiences in his first novel, Vivian Grey. In a smaller exhibition, the choice of exhibits is especially important. They and their captions can sometimes be used to point to future stages in the story. For example, the caption of the drawing of Tita also pointed towards the closeness of Disraeli's working relationship with Queen Victoria, for he was able to persuade her that Tito's widow should be awarded a pension because of his services to Byron. The captions referenced Disraeli purchased the drawing in 1870 hints at a family significance too, for Isaac Disraeli died in Tita's arms. Likewise, the Vivian Grey not only accompanies the extract from the novel, but provides a marked contrast with the uniform adopted by Disraeli in the 1840s to convey his political sobriety and seriousness, and contrast with this intriguing, if imaginative, portrait of Disraeli in action in the Commons. Drawn to our attention after the exhibition had opened, its curiosity value ensuring it a place in the later online exhibition. While curating the exhibition, I was unaware of this equally colourful image, used on a book jacket of Morris Edelman's 1972 novel, Disraeli in Love. I came across this in a second-hand books in Stratford's Oxfam shop and couldn't resist it, largely because of Edelman's connection with Hughenden. Morris Edelman, Labour MP for Coventry from 1945 until his death in 1964, was also a television playwright and novelist, who in his later years had an apartment at Hughenden. Disraeli is the subject of two of his six novels, the other being Disraeli Rising. Well, back to the exhibition. Partly inspired by Tremaine, by Plumer Ward, for whom the Disraeli family rented a house, Disraeli's Silver Fork novel revolves around the adventures of Grey, Disraeli's fictionalised self. The novel is prophetic, pointing towards Disraeli's decision to enter politics, the conflict with Peel in the 1840s, and through its publisher Cockburn, a substitute for Murray, his later link with Longmans. It earned the near-bankrupt Disraeli £500, 140 of which he sent to Murray in payment of a co-investor's debt. But fictionalising the representative saga and depicting Murray as the inebriate Marquis of Carabas would lead to Murray severing connections with the Disraelis, much to the family chagrin. This extract is full of telling comment about the ambitious young Disraeli stroke Grey. The grand object, so much desired, to be in the Senate is revealed on page 54. Gladstone, Disraeli's future Liberal rival, referred disparaging in his diary to the novel being clever but trashy, which didn't augur well for their future relations. Part 2, volumes 3 to 5, appeared in 1827, to less acclaim. 25 years later, Disraeli, embarrassed by the image projected in the novel, tried to exclude it from the 1853 edition of his collected works. I mentioned earlier the importance of collaborations to realise the Disraeli exhibition. Among the loans of artefacts to complement manuscripts from Disraeli's papers, the 1836 portrait of Daniel Maclise of Lady Henrietta Sykes, until then rarely seen in public, complemented the better known image the better known image of Henrietta, the model for Disraeli's 1837 novel Henrietta Temple, lent by Sir John Sykes and his sister Professor Elizabeth Sykes. That better known one was used to illustrate Jane Ridley's essay in the exhibition book. Both pictures illustrate the way fact and fiction mixed in Disraeli's life. Though excellent in many ways, there are gaps in the Huenden papers. Some of this is due to the extensive weeding by Disraeli's private secretary and literary executive Montagu Corrie and to the lawyer Sir Philip Rose, and some to spasmodic dispersal before his papers were acquired by the Trust and judged a historical resource, whose physical integrity should be maintained. Fortunately, as we've just heard, some of these dispersed letters have been reproduced in the multi-volume edition of Disraeli's Letters. Based in Canada, this excellent project, whose work we've heard described, was the source of this letter from Disraeli in Granada to his mother in August 1830. Their relationship was difficult but improved with distance. Here Disraeli writes about his growing identification with Spain, which he later wove into a fantastical recreation of his paternal family's origins. They were cast as aristocratic Jews driven out in the Great Exodus and finally coming to rest in Venice. Here there is a modicum of truth, but no palazzo. The next section of the exhibition, New Horizons 1832-7, is devoted to the run-up to Disraeli's eventual election to Parliament in 1837. A major factor for the choice of manuscripts for the exhibition sprang from the nature of the documents. Crucially, all had been fascicled in the earlier conservation project. Fascicules are large folders of acid-free paper into which items are affixed with rice paper. Items can be removed and mounted for exhibition, as indeed they were by the expert team of conservators working with the in-house exhibition designer, Dana Josephson. But obviously, the less disturbed the items are, the better. Some of the most intriguing letters selected for the Disraeli exhibition ran to several pages. With text written on both sides, it would be impossible to display all the interesting passages in their original form. Similarly, key passages can run over several pages, as in the iconic mutilated diary, so called because Disraeli later excised some entries, but fortunately not these comments. The first pages describe the 1826 Continental tour with the Austens, dull lawyer Benjamin and his wife Sarah, with whom Disraeli had a flirtatious relationship. But the reverse folios begin in 1833 and include such telling phrases as, "My life has not been a happy one. Nature has given me an awful ambition and fiery passion. And later, on pages 18 to 19, "My mind is a continental mind. It is a revolutionary mind. I'm only truly great in action. If ever I am placed in a truly eminent position, I shall prove this. I could rule the House of Commons, although there be great prejudice against me at first." Digitization lifted the constraints on what could be selected. Similarly, we compare more of the draft of the less iconic but milestone marker certainly. His address to the electors in Maidstone, here the printed version, and the drafts. After 5 attempts and 2 changes of party, sent him to Parliament, and through the generosity of the lenders of this jug, ensure that an image of it permanently accompanies the 1837 papers. Around the time of the exhibition planning, and I'm afraid I can't remember the exact date, an application was submitted to the then Mellon-funded Oxford Digital Library, the ODL, then a separate unit from the Bodleian. Securing the funding was crucial to widening the reach of the exhibition, both in increasing access to beyond Oxford to students, the general public, and potentially teachers and school children studying Disraeli at Key Stage 3. I think that part of the curriculum has since been abolished, as well as preserving it as a historical resource. With hindsight, I think if the exhibition was used as a resource by teachers and their classes, it may well have owed more to the fact that the BBC accepted my proposal that their history web pages included a link to the online exhibition shortly after its launch in 2005. One of my few regrets on the exhibition is that there weren't more resources to engage more with teachers in the outreach programme. Now, we left the exhibition narrative at the dawn of Disraeli's parliamentary career. 7 of the remaining sections looked at key stepping stones, and 3 were galleries of affection, friendship and association. Section 5, Mary Ann, Young England and the novel trilogy, covered Disraeli's courtship and marriage to Mary Ann, his leadership of Young England Group, the model for Lord Randolph Churchill's fourth party, and writing of Coningsby, published in 1844, Sybil 1845, and Tancred in 1847. Though set in the 1840s, each represented constant aspects of Disraeli's personality, his close relationships with older women and younger men, his driving ambition to make his mark, and his use of novels to explore political and social ideas. Here we have a rather lovely portrait of Mary Ann. And Disraeli's letter, in which he professes his strength of feeling for her. Among the section's other features, the opening page from an October 1844 letter from Lord John Manners, later 7th Duke of Rutland, the model for Lord Henry Sidney in Coningsby. And Sybil, probably Disraeli's best known novel, with his reference to the existence of two nations, the rich and poor living side by side, but in two separate worlds, ignorant of each other's habits, thoughts and feelings. For this description of social conditions, Disraeli drew on primary and secondary sources and his own observations. With his rejection of materialism and emphasis on social welfare, Sybil is perhaps his most idealistic work. It did not propose specific remedies, but its resonance lasted well beyond the 1840s. After the Second World War, some of the brightest of the new parliamentary intake would form the One Nation group. Sybil was dedicated to Mary Ann. Published like Coningsby in 3 volumes, it too sold 3,000 copies. Both novels made about £1,000 profit each, which Disraeli and Cockburn shared equally. The attractions and the flexibility of the term One Nation endure. Indeed, last year it crossed the political boundary when it was adopted by the Labour Party leader, Ed Miliband. The publication in 1847 of the third novel in the trilogy, Tancred, was interrupted by Disraeli's campaign against Peel. In the exhibition, the novel makes a summary appearance in the captions to Sir Isaiah Berlin's comments on the book in his lecture, Benjamin Disraeli, Karl Marx and the Search for Identity, delivered to the Jewish Historical Society in 1967. The critical moment of Disraeli's success and the fall of Peel in 1846 had been described by Disraeli to Mary Ann in this letter. Note the inclusion, on the left-hand side, of the fictional Coningsby and factual Young England in the same sentence. It would be 22 years before Disraeli himself became Prime Minister. We can see Disraeli savouring his success in 1868. Here, in a confidential letter written from Osborne the day following his becoming Prime Minister, Disraeli describes to his private secretary, Montagu Corrie, his first audience with Queen Victoria as her Premier. About half an hour after he arrived at 7 p.m, the door opened and the Queen came in radiant with smiles, holding out her hand, saying, "You must kiss hands," which he did most heartily, falling on his knee, saying that, "I kissed her hand in faith and loving loyalty." This phrase much appealed to Victoria. Their rapport would be enhanced by his lively written reports to her. Corrie was another of those aristocratic, agreeable young men. His maternal grandfather was the 6th Lord Shaftesbury, with whom Disraeli surrounded himself. He was recruited as private secretary in 1866. Digitisation enabled us to expand the content of the exhibition to include material and research we garnered during and after the exhibition's run. We've already seen one example, the imaginative portrait of the green tail-coated Disraeli speaking in the Commons. Another was this slide, the Primrose League, of the Primrose League, which came into the library with the last tranche of the Primrose League papers. Created in November 1883, the Primrose League was part of the response to the extension of the male franchise, the aim to recruit and maintain support for the Conservatives. It was the brainchild of Lord Randolph Churchill and other members of the Radical Conservative Party faction, the Fourth Party, which existed from 1880 to 85. In the hierarchical structure, partly inspired by medieval guilds, membership was graded 1, the lowest, to 5. With its aristocratic grand knights and dames, it sought to improve the link between the party's central organisation and the rank-and-file membership. The use of Disraeli's favourite flower, the primrose's identifier, is indicative of his continuing value to the Conservative Party over 2 years after his death. By 2005, the League, moribund for many years, had recently been wound up. This portrait and some large banners were among the forgotten contents retrieved from a storage facility by the person appointed to oversee the operation. It's not an especially good portrait, and I recently saw another copy in a local auction house wrongly described as a Victorian politician, possibly William Gladstone. Disraeli might have been amused, but Gladstone very likely affronted. But the image provides a pictorial partner to the plate lent to the original exhibition and to the medal, the Star Medal on the right. These medals were awarded to the knights and dames who'd made outstanding contribution to furthering the principles of the League. This one includes bars for Queen Victoria's 1887 Jubilee and the 1897 Sudan campaign Battle of the Omdurman. Smaller enamel badges were designed as attractive items for female jewellery to encourage regular wear, an early form of brand placement. In the context of today's symposium, both these images also point to the political and commercial uses to which Disraeli's legacy and his representation have been put. The commercial aspects, the manufacturing of plates and tea towels, have long since ceased, but references to Disraeli's political legacy continue into the 21st century. Involved in the decision to include the portraits and other new material in the expanded online exhibition was the project assistant, Sam Hyde, who just completed a postgraduate degree at the University of West of England and would later complete a doctorate in the University of Liverpool. Sam was already familiar with the Huenden papers and other modern political collections, having earlier worked as the manuscript department's assistant. His research in political communication, especially cartoons and printed satire, was invaluable. He was recruited to the project to collaborate with the ODL in delivering the online exhibition. Among the new images he identified and researched and added to the All-In exhibition were six from the radical comic periodical Fun, rival to the older Punch. The bulk of the cartoons are in Chapter 10, First Step, then Leap into the Dark, item 114, dealing specifically with the 1867 Reform Bill. This image of a cartoon by Henry Doyle, the son of John Doyle, who we've heard about, and whose work was already featured in the exhibition, satirises Disraeli's rise as his fictionalised self. As Sam captioned, Vivian's prophecy had been realised, just as it had in 1846, concluding, as Disraeli climbs the steps at Osborne, Doyle bestows on his subject a mixed expression, part roguish, part reverent, part reflective. Fun's comment at the end of Disraeli's political career, his last decoration, was the work of Gordon Thompson. Disraeli bows to receive his last decoration from Britannia, the Order of the Sack. As Sam captioned, behind her back she holds Her Majesty's invitation to Gladstone and Co. to form a new government, a summons Queen Victoria had been loath to transmit. The new images complemented the two from The Hornet and four from Punch, such as this pas-de-deux. It illustrates one of the high points of Disraeli's political career, the Berlin Conference held to resolve the Eastern Question. Disraeli's earlier purchase of the Suez Canal in 1875, the elevation of Queen Victoria to Empress of India in 1876, and his response to the Eastern Question were part of a larger political and foreign policy strategy. His stance attracted the newly enfranchised voters, consolidating the Conservatives' identity as a national party. But this emphasis on the British Empire was a response to the decline in British power in the 1870s. In containing Russia and protecting trade routes to India, he was pursuing traditional British objectives while acknowledging the limited scope for manoeuvre in Europe, save in the Mediterranean area, because of the constraints of the alliance of the German, Austro-Hungarian and Russian emperors. In acknowledgement of their efforts at the Congress of Berlin, both Disraeli and Salisbury were admitted to the Order of the Knights of the Garter, the highest order of the British knighthood. Disraeli made his acceptance conditional on Salisbury being awarded the honour too. This image was one of several sourced from the Bodleian's John Johnson collection of printed ephemera, a major resource in its own right. And this twin portrait of the two rivals sharing space in print more easily than in real life, created in micrographical type with 44,200 characters depicting Disraeli, somewhat more than the 41,600 for Gladstone, the words are in English. It was produced by SOFA in Paris. A prominent feature of both exhibitions and the book were the galleries of affection. The inspiration for these came from the staircase in Huendon, hung with portraits of Disraeli's political colleagues. This gallery of affection testifies to Disraeli's success in winning the support and ultimately, to varying degrees, the friendship of men like Lord Salisbury, once one of his harshest critics. It evokes Disraeli's driving ambition, the struggle to succeed, and perhaps too the inner loneliness which needed such visual reassurance. Alongside the initial selection and captioning of the exhibition, work was also underway on the accompanying book, from which this image, Reform Mapped, is taken. This map of the constituencies throughout the United Kingdom, as then configured, with alterations from the Acts 1867 to 68, was published in 1868. The book contains all the images from the 2003 image, but not, of course, those added to the online version. So the map is item 99 in the book and 118 online. From the outset, Dr. Samuel Fanous, head of Bodleian Publications, was keen that the book should have a life beyond the exhibition. It should be more than just a catalogue. To this end, we invited the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kenneth Clark, and five historians, including the chair of this afternoon's session, Professor Angus Hawkins, to contribute chapters on the themes explored in the exhibition. Ken Clark wrote about Disraeli as the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Professor Hawkins on Disraeli's relations with the Earls of Derby, Annabel Jones on Disraeli and his publishers, Timothy Mole on the novel's impact on the writer William Beckford, and Jane Ridley on Disraeli and women. Each contributor had the option of including an illustration additional to those in the exhibition. Structurally, their five chapters set the scene for the next 10, which formed the exhibition's catalogue. The book fulfilled the publication section's objective. Its shelf life outlasted the exhibition by several years, and it may be said to have extended the reach of the original exhibition, though, as in the way of these things, it's now out of print. So it was a real pleasure to be offered a new way of linking Disraeli's papers with Hughenden in 2007. The National Trust were refreshing the interpretation of Disraeli's life at Hughenden, ready for relaunching the property in the spring of 2008. Mary Ann Disraeli was to have a higher profile, both in the house and the garden. Her meticulously detailed account books featured too, complete with transcripts, because her handwriting, as we've already heard, is fiendishly difficult to read. Visitors to the property were to be given the option of going to the house via the former stables, where they could watch four film presentations on different aspects of Disraeli's life. The four speakers was Lady Lucinda Lambton, talking about Disraeli's relationships, Geoffrey Archer on Disraeli as a novelist, Morris Binks about Disraeli's views on Judaism, and me, introducing Disraeli the politician to visitors, many of whom I was advised may not know about his political career. The interview was to be filmed in the Old Bodleian. The idea being that visitors to Hughenden, having been inspired by their visit to his home and hopefully intrigued by the sight of his papers, would find out more by looking at the online exhibition. Keen to broaden my understanding of Disraeli in preparation for answering the Trust questions in the filming, I explored the media, which I believe influenced quite a number of people, Disraeli, his depiction in films and television. For a day, I immersed myself in the British Film Institute's wonderful archive, to contrast with Anthony Sher's portrayal of the ironically detached Disraeli in the 1996 film, Her Majesty Mrs. Brown, which I already knew. I viewed copies of two popular 1970s TV series, Edward VII, and Disraeli's portrait of a romantic, and the 1950s classic film, Mudlark, with Alec Guinness as Disraeli. But the standout source was a 35mm film made in 1931 for the Conservative and Unionist Party Association films, Impressions of Disraeli. Introduced by Stanley Baldwin, on the right, then leader of the opposition, the film featured George Arliss as Disraeli. In Baldwin's estimation, Disraeli was possibly the only statesman from his grandfather's generation whose speeches could still resonate with contemporary audiences, the longevity of Disraeli's appeal stemming from his vision and rhetoric. Baldwin's admiration for Disraeli and his legacy were not limited to Conservative Party leaders, nor indeed to Conservatives. The exhibition includes two pages from the script of the 1977 television programme, A Prime Minister on Prime Ministers, by the former Labour Premier Harold Wilson, which includes a touching tribute to Disraeli. Arliss, fresh from his award-winning performance as Disraeli in the 1929 film, first addresses us from behind a desk. The theme of Disraeli's speech is what he termed the two kinds of equality, the equality which levels and destroys, and the equality which elevates and creates. This is followed by shots of Arliss standing in a different setting, delivering extracts from Disraeli Shrewsbury speech of 1841, the famous Crystal Palace speech of 1872, and a speech in the House of Lords on empire in 1878. The performance by Arliss, born a year after Disraeli piloted the 1867 Reform Bill, and a seasoned portrayal of Disraeli on stage and in a silent film remade as that 1929 biopic, has the ring of authenticity to it. This page, one of the three pages from the printed copy of the Crystal Palace speech, appears in the exhibition. It is regarded as one of Disraeli's defining contributions to the notion of progressive conservatism. During the Crystal Palace speech on the 24th of June 1872, Disraeli outlined his tenets of conservatism: to maintain institutions, to uphold the empire, and to elevate the condition of the people. Lord Morley, Gladstone's Liberal Party colleague and biographer, later wrote of Disraeli's rare faculty of wide and sweeping forecast. The speech foreshadowed the social legislation which Disraeli's government would introduce in 1875-6, the largest tranche of social legislation in the 19th century. Disraeli, by then exhausted by his climb up the greasy pole to head the first majority Conservative government for decades, had delegated responsibility to ministers. They were not his reforms, but they became part of the progressive Conservative legacy with which he is associated, rightly or wrongly. The chill Disraeli caught on the 22nd of March 1881 proved fatal. He died at his London home, 19 Curzon Street, in the early hours of the 19th of April 1881, the anniversary of Byron's death. His last recorded words were, "I had rather live, but I am not afraid to die." In the immediate aftermath, the demand for his novels, including Endymion, published after the Conservatives lost power in the 1880 general election, was so great that Longman's printing presses had to run night and day. To the very end of his life, fact and fiction were linked. In Endymion, the central character was a young man who arrived by his own energies at the station to which he seemed, as it were, born. The novel examined big themes, the characters inspired by Disraeli's political and literary contemporaries. On publication, the novel, the first ever published by a former prime minister, had been an immediate bestseller. Disraeli is a very complex figure, a man of contradictions. To contemporaries, he was sphinx-like, an attribute he shared with one of his conservative successors, A.J. Balfour, though he was less of a mystery to his immediate family. Disraeli was an outsider who networked effectively in the establishment, a romantic with a willingness to engage in the realities of party politics, an opportunist not lacking in principles, a best-selling novelist with a substantial non-literary output. He became proud of his Jewish antecedents and an upholder of the position of the Anglican Church. Disraeli had the ability to anticipate future trends. He was driven by a Churchillian sense of destiny, but lacked the latter's birthright to ease his path. Disraeli cannot be boxed into the confines of the 19th century. His witticisms, his seminal novel Sybil, now I'm told enjoying a new role as a source of history of the working class gardening, his political legacy, real and disputed, have endured for over 100 years, and as today's symposium shows, his appeal shows every sign of continuing.